please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. What a joyful day. Hokey smokes. Wow. So much fun. Well, it's great because this Shabbat is represents the confluence, the coming together of Chol Hamoed Pesach, the middle days of Pesach, the conclusion coming Monday and Tuesday. By the way, parenthetically, if you can take off Monday, that's one of those days that is good to take off from work. Anyhow, the confluence of that and in the Western world, the celebration of Yeshua's resurrection is this coming Sunday. So what a wonderful coming together. And the idea that struck me as I was reflecting on this is there's nothing more wonderful than hopes realized, dreams fulfilled, promises kept. And that's really what Pesach is all about, and the celebration of the resurrection, Easter, Resurrection Sunday, we might call it. So let's talk about the realization of the promises that God made at the Exodus. Now, you all know the story, but I just want to focus on the Torah portion that we read this morning. It's actually quite short, where God changed the hearts of the Egyptians toward us. Now, you remember earlier on in the account, the Egyptians, we would imagine, I'm talking about the average people, not just Pharaoh, they didn't like us at all. You know, they just didn't like these immigrants from Asia who were destabilizing their country and all these plagues and the destruction of the economy and all that kind of stuff. And so they didn't like us at all. But then the text says, you know, that they changed their minds about us. They gave us their gold and their silver. They were favorably disposed toward us as we left. They realized, wow, your God is really with you. We salute you. We're sorry for what happened, and we feel bad about it, and still a little mad about it too, but our attitude toward you has changed. You must be very favored by God. And so this radical change in attitude, and so they gave them their gold and silver. Now, there's a story about a professor of law from Egypt last year who decided to sue Israel in the world court for all of the gold and silver that we got back in those days. I thought that was kind of interesting, you know what I mean? But it wasn't the first time. Actually, a court in the Talmud, and I don't know if this story sounds apocryphal to me, but it's still so much fun, so I'll share it with you, that during the time of Alexander the Great, which is, you know, roughly 330 BC, etc., that Egyptians made claims against our people for all of that gold and silver until the representative of the Jewish community said, first, we want all the past wages for 400 years of slavery for 600,000 people. Then, after we get remunerated for past wages, then we'll talk about the gold and silver. And then, according to the Talmud, it says, the Egyptians did the math and fled. So, I don't know. So, but the point is, really, after all the misery of slavery, right? All the unhappiness, the misery, the shattered dreams, hopes, the disappointment, you know, where is this God already? Like I talked with you about last week, that we are able to leave with great joy. And if you want to relive the experience, I highly recommend the cartoon version, Prince of Egypt. Have you seen it before? The scene when we're leaving, oh, you want to jump in and just join our people in that. So there's the joy of promises fulfilled, dreams coming true. And the great thing is, it's all real, not just a story. So then we talk about the joy of the resurrection of the Messiah. Let's talk about that a little bit, because there's certain parallels. Well, parallel to the sheer sense of disappointment and desperation that we experienced in Egypt for 400 years of slavery, all of that crystallized in a moment when this guy, this Messiah, Yeshua, who his friends had followed for over 3 years and saw his miracles, and really they liked him a lot. In fact, I think they loved him because he was such a mensch, and because they knew in some sense he was a reflection and an expression of God's very reality, and yet he would sit around the campfire and talk, right? And that juxtaposition of his grandeur and his greatness, and yet sitting around and telling stories around the campfire, kids liked to come up to him, he'd wrestle with them, etc., etc. All of that, I think, endeared him so much to his followers that it is really quite something. But what about when he was arrested and beat up terribly, and the Romans knew how to do it, and all of a sudden he's writhing on an execution stake, and they're thinking, what is going on here? He had told them what was going to happen, but there was no room, I think, in their minds and in their hearts to be able to deal with that. Have you ever experienced something like that? Have you ever learned something that was true, but you couldn't face it at the time? Only long after that could you really face the reality of something? Has that ever been true? I think it's part of the human experience. It's kind of a denial mechanism, a kind of means of survival, if you will. But we, from a safe distance, wonder about how come they were so obtuse. Why? We might even wonder, why were they sad when he was arrested? I mean, wasn't that part of the plan? But that is, from the perspective 2,000 years later, it doesn't reflect the existential reality of being with those people, with those followers of Yeshua who thought, oh my, our world is coming apart. We had really thought this guy was it, and all of a sudden he's naked on a cross being killed, and everyone's jeering at him and laughing at him, and you know what the next thing's going to be. They're going to come after us, right? Because they knew they weren't safe. They were very, very sad, very disappointed, I think profoundly disoriented. I think that's maybe the word that I would use. Disoriented. Their world had been turned upside down. Until, early after the Shabbat, the Sunday morning after Shabbat, Yeshua rested in the grave during Shabbat, right, and honoring Shabbat. But early in the morning, the women went to the cave to finish the halakhic way of burying him, according to the customs of the Jews, the Iudaioi, the Judeans. And they went there, and it was interesting that it was them, because it says a lot about women tend to be more spiritually attuned than us guys anyhow. That's true. And women just get it more easily and better. But aside from that, back in those days, a woman's testimony would not be received in court. Did you know that? Yeah. And so if you wanted to invent a story in a religion, you wouldn't have had women going to the tomb to see these things. You just wouldn't have. You know, you would have had somebody who's higher up on the ladder of social level, if you will. Okay. So they show up, and he is risen. And they go back and tell the guys, he's not there, he's risen, that's what we understand. And they go, yeah, right. Typical, you know, women hysterical, whatever the stereotype might have been back in those days. And then, one by one, or two by two, different groups of the Talmidim experience him. At a couple of times, it's recorded specifically that there were all of them, except Judas Iscariot. Of course, he was not. He was gone by that point. But all the others were together. And Yeshua appears for them, in front of them. And I love this. He appears before them because in the physics of the universe next door, you know, it was no problem. He just appeared in front of them. And he went, Shalom Aleichem. And they went, Aleichem Shalom. He goes, you know, I am hungry. Got anything to eat? And they hand him some fish, and he eats the fish. It doesn't fall on the floor. It's not a hallucination, not a ghost. You know? I love that. And so what happens is that their incredulity, their sense of disorientation and sadness, and that sense of being threatened disappears just like that. When they see him, they go, wow, wow. You see? Because these things which happened are really, really real. They really happened. I love the way in a pre-Freudian age, right, a long time ago when people weren't talking about the inner psychological world of people. That's a modern convention. But nonetheless, what we see as we look back at the way people responded to things, it makes so much sense. There is a certain ring of truth about the way the Talmidim relate to Yeshua and relate to each other. And such a ring of truth to the fact that the people who wrote the book, and it was the same people essentially, but they don't speak of the Talmidim as being larger than life superhero types. They talk about them as not getting it a lot. And isn't that a wonderful ring of truth? I just love that so much, and I live out of that. It's so wonderfully joyful. So, the joy which follows his crucifixion at the resurrection is just astounding. He is alive, and it's the joy which comes from truth. I want to make that point. I think that a lot of religious people are afraid to ask the truth question because of what they might find out. But you know, I'm so happy to say to you that here we're not afraid of the truth question at all. We love the truth question. Is it true? Because we think the evidence is real, real good. And that objective kind of evidence meets with our own inner sense of God's being with us and the experience of answered prayer and the sense of walking with his spirit and all that. So we're joyful because of that. And just as our people in Egypt were joyful because they were vindicated after all that misery, so were his earliest followers, Yeshua's earliest followers, and so were we today. There's a certain vindication, and that vindication will, of course, have its most profound expression future to us. But still, on this day, I want you to, let's get happy. There is a sense of vindication. I think we're, let me put it to you this way, with proper qualifiers. I'm sure that not everything we teach you here is correct. Can't possibly be. We try, we give it our best shot, but I can tell you this, what we teach you is really true, that God has a covenant with the Jewish people that's ongoing, and that he is risen. Amen. You see what I'm saying? That, you can take that to the bank, if you know what I mean. We give it our best shot to give you as much truth as possible. I'm just recognizing the human condition is such that we're all limited. We're talking about huge things. We just give it our best shot when it comes to other particulars. But, hey, our best shot ain't bad. But we are quite sure about certain things. So there is the joy of vindication. There's the joy of truth, the joy of vindication. And I want to suggest there is a kind of special, if you will, messianic Jewish joy, which I'd like to address just for a minute. And it has to do with the fact that the resurrection of Yeshua has a meaning which goes beyond just the individual's relationship with God. You and me, one day, life doesn't end. We're going to go be with him if we walk with him. That's vitally important. And let's get real. Your life is very important to you and should be. But from a Messianic Jewish standpoint, there is a larger picture. The concept of Mechaye HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, has everything to do with the teachings of the Tanakh about the restoration and resurrection of Israel. Ezekiel 37, you recall the dry bones? That whole idea of the dry bones is a picture of not personal resurrection, but national resurrection, the fulfillment of all the promises that God made to our people and which we've struggled to keep the Torah and we've been treated badly and sometimes we don't act so great either, and all the twists, all that happens, the twists and turns and undulations of history, that all of that comes together with all the promises made to our people, validating all the bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and celebrations, and instead of staying home on Saturdays, coming here, all of that will ultimately be validated because there's a larger picture, the larger picture. And that's a source of joy too, that there is a larger picture, and that that larger picture, by extension, goes to the entire world. I'm telling you that the kinds of challenges we face now, they're real. Who knows what's going to be this weekend with a flotilla of American warships headed for North Korea? Don't know. But this I promise, God will see to it that life on planet Earth ultimately will be tov ma'od, wonderful in every sense. Isn't that a great thing? And isn't it great to live for his program to help effectuate that as we get up every day? So, what do we have? The resurrection means joy. The exodus from Egypt is joyful. The joy of knowing a God who loves us to the point of self-sacrifice. This is a huge thing. That there's Yeshua willing to die at the hands of his own creation is an incredible indication of the character of God's love, that he sacrifices. Parents understand this with kids, but we're talking about the creator of this universe and who knows how many others, and he says, you know, I just love those people on earth, okay, the only way they're going to get it, we're going to have to atone for their sins, and here's how it has to happen. So it's a source of joy. We have to follow a God who guarantees goodness and blessing who'll follow him. But how shall our joy continue throughout the year? And for this, I want to tell you, and I'll conclude with this, a Hasidic story. This is a story attributed to the Baal Shem Tov, who, of course, started the Hasidic movement in Eastern Europe. You know that preceding the Messiah is the coming of who? You know this. Eliyahu, right? Elijah the prophet. And so he shows up. And that's why at the Passover Seder, right in there the other day, we said, kids, go see if Elijah's here yet. They all go out. I always worry that we're not going to get them back, you know. But so far, we've been good about that. I'll tell you one. I heard a story a professor of mine said, one day he was leading the Passover Seder, sent all the kids out. The kids came back. The leader, he said, well, was Elijah there? And the kids said no, except one little guy said, yep, he was, I saw him. So he had to stop the Seder, go out, double check again. That was a cute moment. So this is the story. The Baal Shem Tov had a Talmid, a student, who said to him, oh, I so yearn at this coming Pesach, it's Passover season, I so yearn to see Eliyahu HaNavi. So the Baal Shem Tov says to him, well, here's what I want you to do. Fill a big bag with the finest china, beautiful candlesticks, a magnificent meal, all the accoutrements of the most magnificent Seder. Fill that bag, put it on your shoulder, and I'm sending you to a little house at the end of a forest, far from here. And when you get there, knock on the door. The follower, his Talmid, does this, his disciple does this. He goes, and there in the edge of the forest is a little beat-up shack, really beat up. He knocks on the door, and the door opens. It's a little, a frail couple, an elderly couple, and they invite him in, and he shares with them, and they have Pesach together. At the end, he leaves and goes back to the Baal Shem Tov, but he's sad. He said, you know, I didn't see Eliyahu the prophet. So the Baal Shem Tov says, here's what I want you to do. Go back to the house. And don't go in, but rather stand outside the door listening carefully. So when he stood outside the door, he heard how happy they were. They were too poor to even to save a morsel for Pesach. And he heard them say, but Eliyahu HaNavi came to be with us. And we've had a wonderful Passover. I leave you with that story as a way to respond this coming year to the joy of Pesach and the joy of the resurrection of Yeshua. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah's sake. For Messiah's sake.